Revelation chapter 2 tonight, and in 2 weeks' time I'll be back speaking about what is happening in some of the countries you've been to. It's a bit difficult sometimes speaking. You don't want to talk all the time about what you're doing. It's a bit embarrassing, as if that's important. It is important in a way, because I think it's important from the point of view of accountability. I mean, if missionaries are going in different places doing things, then those who support them ought to know what they're doing. So it's important that we do tell you what we're doing. But that can be a very distorted picture, because that's just what I'm doing. And it may or may not be representative of what's happening across the board in that country. So I want to give a little bit of both. I want to talk a bit about what Gay and I did in these countries, and I also want to talk about the state of the church and Christian activity in these countries. Gay didn't do a lot on this occasion. She had two lots of surgery last year, which slowed her up a bit. And in fact, she didn't go to all these places with me. I left a few weeks before she did, and I went to some of the rougher countries by myself, where things were difficult, and I had a lot of travel in remote areas and things like that. I did those areas by myself, and then she joined me later on. And so we were the main part together. And then at the end of the trip, when we were through the southern parts of Africa, she came home and then left me to tramp around Botswana and Namibia by myself, and then I came home a bit later. So we had to sort of work it as best we could. She got her tuppence worth along the way, mind you. She was able to do various things. But most of the work was really concerning me, so pardon me if I talk about what I did. As I say, Gay wasn't involved in a lot of this for various reasons. I want to talk also about the state of the church, as I said, in these countries. And I want to illustrate it from the letters to the churches in the book of Revelation. And I hope there's something for us in this as well. Now, I was brought up, told, that these seven letters to the seven churches in Asia Minor represented seven eras of church history. I'm not sure that that's an adequate explanation of them. I think the main thing is that these seven letters were in fact written to seven churches. And those churches were in the western part of Asia Minor that we today call Turkey. And you can see characteristics of those churches anywhere. You can see different characteristics in different places. And one of the things that I was told was that today we are living in the era of the church in Laodicea, and that this is a period of what was called Laodicean lukewarmness, where the Lord of the church, the risen Christ, said, "I have something against you. You're neither hot nor cold. You're lukewarm, and I'm going to spew you out of my mouth. You say, I am rich. I have prospered. I need nothing, but you don't know that in fact you are wretched, pitiable, poor and blind and naked." And so it goes on. Now that may be a fairly good description of the church in the West. And you see, one of the things is when we make these generalizations that the church today is in a state of Laodicea and lukewarmness, we are thinking of the people in the West. It's amazing how we read the Bible and interpret history solely in terms of the Western world, Western Europe, English-speaking Western European countries. In fact, if you look at the world today, that is not typical of most of the church. The church in the West only represents probably about a quarter of the Christians in the world. Three quarters of the Christians in the world are in Africa and Asia and Latin America. And in the majority of those places, they are in fact persecuted, they're suffering, and they're poor, but spiritually they're alive and going ahead. In fact, the most Christian continent in the world is Africa. Wouldn't believe it, but it's true. The greatest number of Christians, whether you're talking about nominal Christians, I'm talking about born-again Christians, the real thing, the most Christian continent is in fact Africa. The least Christian continent is Europe, which is of course where it started, and where we have the exploits of Paul, and where we have the early church, and even the Reformation. But now Europe is as spiritually dead and dormant as you can, as you can wish, as you should not wish. It really badly needs re-evangelizing. And the centre of gravity has shifted out of Europe into some of these parts of Asia, Africa, Latin America. So it's not true to say that across the board that the church today is wealthy and rich and affluent. In the West it may be, but in the rest of the world, you can come back to chapter 2, for example, the church in Smyrna, verse 8. In verse 9 it says, you have tribulation and poverty. Now that would be very typical of the church in many parts of the world today. Great persecution and poor. Actually, spiritually they're rich, but physically they're poor. And they're suffering. But not every country is suffering. Some of the countries are poor and not suffering. Some of them are poor and they are suffering. That is suffering persecution. Now I'm going to speak more about that next week when I speak about Africa. And you can't generalize even in Africa because it's vastly different from Egypt and Sudan in the north, which is where we were in the north, down to Botswana, Swaziland, Namibia and places like that in the south. Entirely different in terms of the state of affairs in the church. Tonight we're going to talk about Eastern Europe. And Eastern Europe, if we want to find some parallels, it's probably in the first letter, the letter to Ephesus in chapter 2, verse 1, to Ephesus. Now Ephesus was a church that had stood for God in the face of great persecution, mainly from within the church, from people who wanted to destroy it through false teaching. And if you go back through the stories in the book of Acts, and even if you read the letter to the Ephesians, you can find references. You remember Paul talking to the church in Ephesus at the end of his journeys. He said, fierce wolves are going to come in and they're going to mix up this church and make a real mess of it. And when you look at some of the early heresies that were fought against in the epistles of John and in the Gospel of John and in other letters of the New Testament, a lot of those were centred in Ephesus. Ephesus became a hotbed of false teaching. But the people in Ephesus stood firm against false teaching. Verse 2, I know your works, your toil, your patient endurance. I know that you cannot bear evil men. You've tested those who call themselves apostles but are not, and you found them false. I know that you are enduring patiently, and you're bearing up for my name's sake, and you've not grown weary. But, verse 4, I've got this against you. You've abandoned the love you had at first. You've lost your first love. And you've got to change, because if you don't change, I'm going to remove that church, because if a church has no love, then I've got no use for it, says the Lord of the church. Now, in some ways, that is the state of affairs in many of the countries of Eastern Europe. You have to admire these people, the way they stood through years and years of communist oppression. It was difficult. Mind you, again, it's difficult to generalize across all those countries. I found when I was there, for example, speaking to people in different countries, and this was something of an education process for us as well, I found that these people couldn't generalize because in some countries it was very, very tough, and in others it wasn't all that bad. I mean, it was bad compared with what we are, but it wasn't all that bad compared with some of the other communist countries. For example, the Warsaw Pact. The Warsaw Pact countries were those countries that were under the thumb of the Soviet Union. But not all the communist countries were in the Warsaw Pact. There were two of them outside. One of them was Yugoslavia, that was always a bit of a maverick, and it was more or less off with a bit more freedom. They interacted more with people from other countries, and although it was communist, and there were restrictions on the church, it wasn't as tough in Yugoslavia as it was in those other countries. Out on the other extreme, which was also not part of the Warsaw Pact, was Albania, and it was the toughest of the lot. Absolutely frightful the way the government sought to completely obliterate Christianity from that country. Now in between those two extremes you've got these half a dozen Warsaw Pact countries, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Poland, what else? Romania, Bulgaria, Russia and so on. East Germany, those countries. It was the people in Poland who told me this. They said really of those countries, they said we had it the best. If you can use the word best. But they said, we didn't get it as tough as the people next door in Czechoslovakia. They said they really had it rough. They said the roughest of the lot were Bulgaria and Romania. But Czech Republic and Slovakia were not far behind them. It used to be one country, but now it's two. And East Germany had it rough. Hungary wasn't quite so bad. And they said we had it a bit easier because the country, Poland, is basically Roman Catholic, 100% Catholic, which meant that the government had to make some concessions to the church, and so evangelical Christians enjoyed similar concessions. that's what I say, it's very difficult to generalize. But you have to admire these people, the way they stood firm in the face of this attempt by the government to squash their spirit. Virtually right through all those countries, they were not allowed to do anything outside the four walls of the church. In some countries, they found it great difficulty even in meeting as churches. Like in Bulgaria, for example, most of the assemblies went underground. But in other places, in Romania, they were allowed to function, but they had to function within a cooperative arrangement that the government set up, and they had councils and presidents who were answerable to the government and so on. And that seems to have applied also in Czech Republic, in Poland, and in Slovakia. But in all of those countries, if they were allowed to operate, they could only operate here. They could come along on Sunday and do what they wanted to do on Sunday. They were not allowed to evangelize. There was no outside activity. And there are restrictions on Christian literature. They couldn't distribute literature. And, you know, the sorts of things that we're probably aware of. But in the process, they became rather cold. They became wooden and legalistic and hard and rigid. And over 50 years of that, they became so inward-looking that you've had several generations bred in this very closed environment. Now that freedom's come, some of them don't know quite what to do with it. And they become so set in their ways and so bogged down with a rigid, legalistic sort of a Christianity that they still have no love for the lost, and they're still not doing anything to outreach. And if somebody does want to go out and outreach, they say, oh, but we're the Lord's people, we've got to keep ourselves pure and unspotted from the world, and so we just keep it nice and cozy within the fellowship, and so there's a deadness. I'm not just talking of the brethren, incidentally. The other evangelical groups are suffering from the same problem. But in every case, there are some exceptions. And so I don't want to give you all the grim news. I want to point out tonight some of the good things that are happening in different places. I'm just going to give a brief run through, and we're going to show the slides. When I finish the slides, there's nothing more. That's the end of the meeting. I'll talk till about 7 or something, and then I've got 25, 30 minutes of slides. We'll be through by 7:30. When we go into these countries, whether it's these countries of Eastern Europe, Africa, or anywhere else, I know what we're going to do when we go there. I just don't walk into a country uninvited. The only places we go to are places where we're invited to go and do something, and it's fairly specific. We know more or less what's planned in each country, and it's never quite the same in any two countries. Now, once you get there, of course, all sorts of avenues open up, so you do other things as well. But they're all countries where my books have already gone in. Eastern Europe, of all the regions of the world, Eastern Europe will probably be the place that uses my books least, and Southern America, because it's Latin America, Portuguese and Spanish areas. Not a lot of my stuff's gone in there. Most of my books go into the former British colonies of Africa and Asia and the Pacific, where English is the main language. And probably 80% of all the books. Books have gone into more than 100 countries now, but probably about 80% of all those books have gone into fewer than half of those countries, and they're the countries where English is the main language. And then you come down through places where there is a sort of a lesser use of English, places like Nepal or Burma or Egypt or Sudan or some place that's had some association with Britain. And then you come to the smaller places where English is not widely used at all, such as the former Eastern European countries and the old French, Spanish, Portuguese colonies. But you'll find that in most of those places, among the top people, if I can use that expression, the leaders of various ministries, there are people who are competent enough in English to benefit from my books. So whereas 500 sets of these books might have gone into a place like Kenya or Nigeria or Zimbabwe, only maybe 40 or 50 sets would go into a place like, say, Sudan or Burma or places like that, but only maybe 5 or 10 sets have gone into each of these European countries. So I'm not talking about a lot, but they've started to use them, and especially in some of the ministries, those who are leading in different Christian ministries use this as resource material, and so relationships develop. I've got to know people through a variety of ways that will come out as we move through the story. And now out of that, translation projects develop. The books are in 13 languages at present, and there's about another 7 or 8 in the process of translation. We never go into any place and ask people to translate. We simply push in a few books and see what happens. And after a while, somebody writes back and says, look, can we translate this into Swahili or Hindi or Slovakian or whatever the language is? And we have no mechanism to finance that for them. They've got to rustle up their own capital if they want to do that sort of thing. We have sponsorships here to push these books in English. Some of you have a purple leaflet that was given out to sponsor books into these countries that can't afford them. But if they want to go ahead and translate, we suss them out to see that we're dealing with somebody that we believe is a reputable organisation. And we give them permission. We don't charge anything. There's no royalties or anything like that. And I don't get any income out of all this, incidentally. We're just there to try to help these people get these materials. And then they will write to the Sir John Lang Trust or Feed the Minds or World Vision or Tear Fund or Christian Enterprises or some international aid agency and try and get some funds from them. Incidentally, it's a while since I've been here. I know a lot of you have seen these books. But this is what we call the Christian Workers' Kit. It started off with a series of eight books, commentaries from Genesis through to Revelation. And these, incidentally, are now in a one-volume thing called the Bridge Bible Commentary. So these are the same, really. And then we have the Bible Dictionary, Bible Directory, which is an A to Z of biblical data, information. And then there's a basic Christianity series for non-Christians or new Christians, what Christians believe about this and that. And finally, this grew up out of my exploits in some of these countries, running seminars with pastors and teachers and elders and Christian workers on how to understand the Bible and how to teach it simply in our ministry. And it's called Let the Bible Speak for Itself. And it's a handbook on what I just mentioned. So that when we put all this together, we have a Christian, what we call a Christian Workers' Kit. And most of these countries, especially in Africa, most of the Christian workers have virtually nothing. They've got a Bible and that's about it. And all the children's aids and teaching aids and concordances and things we take for granted, most of them have naught. But at least if they get this, they've got something. They've got a commentary on the whole Bible, they've got a dictionary on the whole Bible, they've got a basic Christianity series for discipleship and introducing people to the basics of Christianity, and they've got a handbook which gives them some help and guidance in how to understand and teach the Bible. So they're the things that we push into these countries. Just as a little bit of a something different, I've got my box of tricks here. This is just a miscellaneous collection of some of the translations. I did this off just a some of the oldies at Bethany might like to see some of these things, and I took them along there the other Tuesday night, and it generated enormous interest. So I might scatter them around or bring them next time. If you want to look at them, you can. Some of you may have heard or read Eunice Rhodes has just supervised the translation of my commentary on Acts, Romans, Corinthians into Sanga, that's in Zaire. That's a Hindi version of the four Gospels. This is a series in Chichewa, which is the language of Malawi in Africa. This is there's a series of these. It's a language of India. That's the Basic Christianity series. That's a series of the Basic Christianity in Swahili, which is the language of main language of Central Africa. That's some of the old Thai versions. They're all being updated in fancy covers now. Here's the Basic Christianity series in Bulgarian, and as you can see, they are quite a more up-to-date, attractive sort of a format. That's Bulgarian. There's Telugu. This is Genesis to Deuteronomy in Telugu, which is the language of the Godavari area in East India. Let the Bible Speak for Itself in Thai, which has just come off the press over there. That's Let the Bible Speak for Itself in Hindi. That's the whole commentary in Hindi. This is Oriya, which is the language of Orissa State, up south of Calcutta, a sort of primitive, village type production. This is the Bible Dictionary in Hindi, and this is the language of India, of course. The Bible Dictionary in Swahili, again in Africa. Here's the Bible Dictionary, or half of it anyway, in Thai, and of course all the commentaries and stuff. There's other stuff there. But you can look at that later on if you're interested. But it's amazing how the thing has just sort of grown and grown and grown. Well, it leaves me only about 5 minutes to cover the countries that we visited in Eastern Europe. Just a brief summary. I'll go through these roughly in the order that they'll appear on the screen. These are not necessarily the order in which we visited them. Yugoslavia, which is Serbia. The work we were involved in was in the north of Yugoslavia. That's where all the assemblies are. Incidentally, virtually all this work in Eastern Europe, the contacts came through assembly workers and missionaries and personnel that I'd met. I'd met some of these at the Brethren Conference in Manila, in Lausanne Congress on World Evangelization in 1989. There were about 150 brethren there among the 4,000 other people, and they came from 30-odd countries. And we sort of got together, and it was an eye-opener to see what's happening in some of these countries. And then, to keep ourselves informed, there was a follow-up of that a few years later in 1993 in Singapore, and there was another follow-up just in June of this year in Rome, and you might find it's mentioned in Missionary Tidings, a bit of a write-up there. There are 50-odd countries represented at the one in Rome. Now, these, especially the German brethren have a very virile missionary outreach. They got more missionaries than Australian Missionary Tidings, and at Wiedenest in Germany, that's the sort of German equivalent of Australian Missionary Tidings. They also have a Bible school, and it's like Emmaus and Glow and Tidings all rolled into one. That's the Wiedenest setup, and they facilitated a lot of our operations in Eastern Europe. I've worked a lot with these German brethren over the years. In fact, they finance the publishing of those books in Swahili. And they've also got a project going in Korea and also in Nepal, and also some of these Eastern European countries. And then if you read Echoes of Service, you'll find a couple of chaps there that have carried on ministry through those countries in the bad years of communism, and they opened up further avenues. International teams, OM, Operation Mobilization, IFES, the InterVarsity Fellowship Ministries, Campus Crusade, Scripture Union, a lot of these works, we have contacts through these ministries in all the countries, just about all the countries where we work, and so we've got all sorts of avenues into these places. But it's mainly among brethren that we're working in the north of Yugoslavia. Most of those Eastern Bloc countries, the Baptists and the brethren were more or less forced to combine under the communists, and since freedom's come, they've more or less gone their separate ways, but sometimes they still have quite a bit to do with each other. There are about 45 Protestant churches in the north of Yugoslavia. About a third of those are brethren and two-thirds Baptists. And they all look very much the same, really. But a few years ago, they got an initiative going. They now have about 9 full-time workers, and they set up a thing called the Christian Evangelization Center or something. They had a building, which they obtained from the government virtually for nothing. It was decrepit, falling apart. They got various people from England and America to go and help them restore it. And now they have it as a headquarters. They have radio ministries there, discipleship classes. They have evangelism. They work among druggos. They work among refugees. They've got a stack of refugee work going there. These are all people from the other side of the country that have had to flee Croatia into Serbia. And, of course, you've got Serbians that had to flee back into Croats flee from Serbia over into Croatia. It's total confusion. But they've now started to see some real growth. And praise the Lord, some things are happening there. Some of the churches looked a bit cross-eyed at them at first when they got this ministry going, but they've all more or less swung around behind them now. And so I had a big ministry around some of these assemblies, but mainly I was working among the staff of this organisation with the sort of input that I just mentioned in relation to my books. Moving to Czech Republic, and I can probably combine Czech Republic and Slovakia into one. I think there's 40-odd assemblies in the Czech Republic and 30-odd in Slovakia, and most of them fairly bogged down, but there are a couple that have really cut loose and started to do some new things, and they're the ones that we had most contact with. And so we spent some time, actually we're in 3 different areas in Czech Republic, and had a fair variety of different sorts of churches, but they, in a town called Ostrava in the north, they started an outreach work. Just a young couple in their early 30s. They saw from the scriptures that they ought to be outreaching. And they hadn't been to any Bill Hybels seminars or anything special, hadn't got any fancy glossy literature from America. But just from reading the Bible, they had come to the conclusion that they ought to be doing something about reaching the unconverted outside there. And so they started to reach out. Some of the conservative people in the main, or the only assembly in town, didn't like this too much, especially when they got a few converts and they started a new assembly, and they said, oh, this is being divisive. That city has 350,000 people. Now, that's the number of people that used to be in Brisbane when I was at school, 350,000, and there were 20 assemblies in Brisbane in those days. But there's only one, and as soon as somebody starts some sort of outreach to start another one, they say you're being divisive. Not much vision, is there? You see what I mean? There's a very, very blinkered sort of view of life. Anyway, you'll be happy to know that they've been reconciled to these others. And in fact, I preached this other place as well when I was there, and they're quite happy to welcome each other. But this young fellow and his wife, they started out, and they've seen about 40 people converted, which is 40 more than have been converted in the headquarters. But and now they're getting a building and just trying to get the thing more developed. Praise the Lord, some good things happening. Incidentally, in all these countries, the brethren really just about run Transworld Radio. In Yugoslavia, in Czech Republic, in Slovakia, and in Poland, the director seems to be a brethren. And so they've been very active in that way. Give credit where credit's due. They haven't been very active in person-to-person contact around their localities, but they've been very active behind a microphone, getting out over the sound waves. And it's been a very worthwhile ministry. So that's something good about Czech and Slovakia. Poland, just a word about Poland. The work there, as I said, has been a bit more open, and the assemblies are a bit more open too. Largely through the work of a man called Henry Turkanik, who about 20 years ago started a Bible school over weekends. Just run Saturday and Sunday. It's a 4-year course, and people come in. It's just something attached to the local gospel hall there, and they camp the weekend there, and then they go back home. 4 years is the course, but that's been a tremendous influence over 20 years, and it's given a more relaxed atmosphere. About 1981, the government of Poland relaxed the rules about governing churches, and they said you don't have to be in these big conglomerate masses any longer. And so the brethren and the Baptists were allowed to divide and go back to being what they were before. Well, some of them went back to being brethren, went back to being Baptists, and some stayed independent or something else. But going back to 1981, that left them with about 21 assemblies in that southern area of Poland. But today there are now 35. So that's a growth of 14 assemblies in 15 years, which is a fairly good growth rate. So some good things are really happening in Poland. Just a word about Russia. I was with Brenton Milne from International Teams, who for 11 years or so did a great work undercover in those communist countries, and then for 4 years was in Moscow. He has just moved to London, mainly because Moscow is so hopelessly inefficient that it's more difficult getting around Europe out of Moscow than it is getting out of London. But he is really concerned with setting up publishing, Christian publishing enterprises in these former European countries. All the people I've just mentioned know him. He's been involved with all those Eastern Bloc countries. And in Russia, in contrast to the other countries where I was preaching quite a lot and running discipleship courses and training programs with elders and teachers and Christian workers, in Russia I spent the whole of the time networking with Christian literature organizations, publishers and so on, not only in Moscow but also St. Petersburg and Vyborg up way up the north. I wasn't able to get into Kazan or down to Odessa on the Black Sea, where there are big publishing operations trying to get going, but they also have got my books. We're able to make contact with them, and out of all this we expect that there will be some translations of these things in Russian. Already there are projects in Slovakian, as I mentioned before, and we hope also in Polish. Well, that's a very miscellaneous bits and pieces account of what we're doing. We'll put on some slides and that will sharpen up anything that I've said, and we'll move through fairly quickly. If we can have the lights out, I'll take this machine. Okay, we start in Yugoslavia. This is in the town of Basky Petrovich in the north of the country. The churches, of course, are Orthodox churches, Eastern Orthodox, who are something of a problem to the evangelical cause. They're more of a problem than the Catholics, actually. It was winter, just the end of winter when I was there. As you can see, a heap of snow and no leaves on the trees. Pretty cold, and like all of those countries, bikes everywhere, not a lot of road transport in the form of cars and trucks and so forth. And these villagers, they have this, it doesn't look to me to be the most comfortable gear they wear, layers upon layers, well they tell me anyway, it's layers upon layers of stuff that helps to keep them warm. They all have their bike to wheel goods home from the market. There's a view down one of the markets. I hope this thing doesn't give up on me. It sounds a bit sick. That's the building, the big building in the middle is the one I mentioned earlier, where they acquired this from the government at a nominal figure and have restored it. And downstairs they have large areas to store goods. In fact, look at that bus. That bus has just come from assemblies in Italy. The government of Yugoslavia is providing accommodation for refugees, but nothing else. And it depended almost entirely upon churches. Well, the assemblies in Britain have really been great in supporting. They've got semi-trailers, load of stuff that have come over, and now for the first time, this group of Italians came to distribute and give some of the food. This is one of the meetings. I had meetings every night in this, about 200 people every night. In fact, the numbers grew as the week went on, which is encouraging. And this is upstairs in that building you just saw. I ran a series just for the general populace. We went through Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, Zechariah through the week. Distribution of some of the food to the refugees. These are all Serbian people who've had to flee from Croatia. There's not much future for them. There's no work around. High unemployment in all these former communist countries where once they have to stand on their own feet, you find how inefficient the government ran everything before, and so there's high unemployment. And that's just the local gospel hall on Sunday morning. They drove their tractors across. These people came across from Croatia, and you've got the same picture on the other side of the country in Croatia, of course, of people carrying all their worldly possessions. There's not much they can do. There's no work to do on the farms because the farmers themselves are flat out keeping themselves afloat. A few of them get a bit of casual work around the streets or working as labourers, but it really is a bit rough. And the government has commandeered, this is a gymnasium, or what do you call it, at the local high school, indoor sports, you know, you play basketball and things like that at the local high school, and so there's a whole stack of refugees camped in there. There's houses, public buildings around the town. That just caught my attention, a car that's riddled with bullet holes. I suppose it's amusing if it's not you. You don't see any signs of the war around the area where I was. There was no fighting there. They were fighting in other places. One of the new buildings, this is something really good. The fellow on the left is a Brethren character. The fellow on the right is a Baptist. And each of them have started outreach works with the blessing of their home churches, even though the home churches are far more conservative than they are. But they have seen a lot of people converted. They each have churches now, 30 or 40, especially fringe people off the streets that are wandering around with not a lot of direction in life, and so they seem to have a ministry for them. The fellow on the right is the bloke you just saw before. The chap on the left is the man actually who organised me. He's in charge of this evangelistic centre. I first met him in Manila in 1989, and we've had a lot to do with each other since. But the photo is taken at a campsite that they're developing up in the mountains. So this is another development which has come since freedom. The sorts of ministries that we take for granted here of camps reaching youth, church camps and so on. We're up in the mountains here, visiting another refugee centre, and just an interesting picture of someone bringing timber out of the bush. This campsite up in the mountains, a little bit like a national fitness camp, the government again has taken it over and turned it into refugee accommodation. This is the dining room, obviously, and some of the refugees there, we have a bit of a meeting first and a few items and a gospel talk and so on. Then the food is distributed, and we visit around the places. Now, I was just a bit of a hanger-on here, I suppose, but we spent a couple of hours going around. As long as there was an interpreter in each group, it was okay. Just to let you know that not everything is primitive and in the bush, this is the nearby town of Novi Sad, which is the chief town of the north of Yugoslavia. And wherever you go, all those communist countries, of course, loads and loads of this sort of accommodation. That is far more attractive than what you see in most of the other communist bloc countries. They really are pretty frightful, these flats. We're now in Prague, which is the capital of Czech Republic. Spring, of course, is here, so these photos are several months later than what you've just been looking at. Prague is a very attractive city, lots of old architecture. At least the communist governments didn't destroy the old buildings, not here. They did in Romania. You've probably seen pictures and heard stories of Romania and what a mess they made there. But in these other countries, they more or less left things. They didn't maintain everything. Most buildings were left with paint peeling off them and a very drab grey and brown all over the place, but at least they didn't knock them down. But since freedom has come, there's restoration work going on everywhere. I think every building you see there has been restored probably in the last 5 years. Centre of town, John Huss. Any of you who have read church history will know that he was one of the forerunners of the Reformation, started in Czechoslovakia about 100 years before Martin Luther came on the scene. Just again, some of the buildings. These Europeans, they have this fascination with crazy clocks that are very ancient and impossible to read, but very clever, they tell me. Some of the, again, the buildings are really exquisite. And if you're interested in good King Wenceslas looking out on the Feast of Stephen, well, that's him. He was the king of the country about 1,000 years ago. When you get out into the towns, you get quite a contrast. Most of it is very drab and ugly. The communists didn't seem to bother too much about paint. And village after village, town after town, as you drive through East Germany and Czech, Slovakia, Poland and so on, you have these very unattractive looking buildings. This man is chief man among the brethren in the Czech Republic. Lovely brother. And this is where we stayed, as his wife and son there. Again, a fairly drab sort of a building and very cramped accommodation. But trams all over. This is just outside his house. All those European countries still have trams. I always seem to arrive in these places. We drove, incidentally, around some of these countries. We didn't drive in Yugoslavia, but these countries we had a car. And it's a bit of a bother finding your way around when all the road signs are unreadable for us, plus the fact you're driving on the wrong side of the road. And then you get there and there's a meeting that night. And so before we went to the meeting, he just made a detour up to the top of the hill to give me a look at the town. You can see all those part of the town's been restored. You can see some ugly stuff there as well of the apartment blocks. That man, I said he's chief man among the brethren. That's because the system still operates there, where all the brethren are in a union and there's a president. Some of these presidents are fairly tough characters, and they don't want to dismantle the structures once they've got the power. But that man is not like that, and he's been a really encouraging influence, especially to that young fellow I mentioned who's had a bit of a tough time getting his work established. He also is the chairman of Transworld Radio. This is a rather attractive village, not far from where we were staying. If you wonder what the yellow stuff is, it's canola. You see a lot of it all through those countries. The reason I went out here was that they wanted to show me this ancient printing press, which goes back to the time of John Huss that you saw earlier, and the early translation of the Bible. The person who set this up also got martyred by the Catholic Church, and he was a forerunner of John Wycliffe and these other people who did the same in England. A little bit of a museum. Ostrava in the north, you've read and probably seen pictures of the horrible pollution in many of these Eastern Bloc countries. I did a rough count of about 50 chimneys, most of them belching guck out into the atmosphere. And this is the town of Ostrava that I mentioned, about 350,000 people, where this young chap and his wife have just started this new work. And they've now got between 40 and 50 people in that assembly. That's the fellow just coming out of the gate there. And they're trying to buy part of this building. There's the building that you see there consists of about 5 units, and they're trying to buy one. It's where they're now having their meeting. It was really encouraging to see the outreach that they're doing. Across the border now into Poland, and you see signs of Catholicism all over the country, these shrines in the fields, and so on. Fairly pleasant sort of countryside. It was, canola again there, scattered through the fields. And this is the man, or this is the building I mentioned, where this man has started his Bible school about 20 years ago, and they have an average of 25 to 30. I took all the studies there for the final week or two of their semester, plus meetings in the church, and visited 4 or 5 other assemblies in the region. The town that they're located in, no shops. This is what you notice in a lot of those places. Anything that was built by the communists, they didn't cater for shops very much, because they're all just local cooperatives run by government or government agencies. And since freedom has come, there's a great scramble to try to find retail space. So a lot of little shops like this have grown up around bus terminals and railway stations, along the footpath, just to give free market economy a chance to work. Bread and sausages, of which you have plenty when you're travelling through those countries. This is down at the local bus station, and again some of the housing blocks behind, and you can see the shops that have been erected along the footpath. It's all rather scatty, but at least it's getting the economy running again. Up into one of those apartments to this couple, this elderly couple that we visited. The connection here is that this woman was an escapee from Auschwitz concentration camp towards the end of World War II. She was only in her teens, and she was converted only about 10 years ago. Her husband was converted only 4 years ago, and he's now at Bible school in his third year. And they were determined to show some hospitality. In fact, Henry, who took us along and interpreted for us, they can't speak any English, this couple, but he said this was the first time they'd shown any hospitality, and we had a lovely time. They shared their faith and some of their experiences. Pokey, pokey little apartment that they're squashed into. Well, seeing we've mentioned Auschwitz, Auschwitz was only about 50 kilometres from where we were staying, so on the Saturday morning, Henry ran us out there just for a couple of hours, quick zap around Auschwitz concentration camp. This housed about, I think, about 25,000 people, some of the ovens where they burned them. And from there we went around to Birkenau, which is only about 2 kilometres away, and you see that building in a lot of films and pictures and books. That was a central administration block for Birkenau concentration camp. You can still get up into the tower, as you can see, and from the tower you get a view over part of the area. Now, 120,000 people were incarcerated here at any one time, and they preserved just about 20 of the barracks. The barracks swing right around as far as you can see in 180 degrees from where we're looking here, and that's where they stacked them in. The second block here is the ablutions block. So if you want to see what a multi-seated toilet looks like, there you have it. I did a count, and there are 200. There are three banks here. You can only see two of them here, but back to back on each bank. And there were 67 in each of the three banks of toilet spots. They must have had them very well regulated and didn't do much for your dignity either. Leaving Poland, we had to go over the top to get down into Slovakia, so this is through some rural areas. The things you see right through the old communist bloc countries, the very primitive farming methods. Rather misty and rainy up in the top, but I just thought I'd show you a picture of one or two of places. This is a sort of mountain resort, I guess, where some of the better people used to come and have a holiday. Over the other side, and went into Slovakia, and drove through a long valley, lots of farming activity. Rather attractive country. You can see the little farmhouses scattered around, people working in the fields, etc.